Okay, Henry, here's Charles, who is so developmentally arrested by this mother's sense of mothering that not only has he not been in the men's room alone, she claims that he doesn't have the hand movement to zip up and zip down his zipper. Now, this is some of the art from this same person, the young kid that I'm talking about. Here's a person who can tell you this is, he is a genius, a prodigy in dealing with Civil War facts. He can tell you the names of Civil War historical figures. He can spell their names. He can tell you birth dates. He can tell you ages. He can tell you their kids. He is an absolute genius when it comes to facts about the Civil War. This is one of his pictures. And these pictures are now being displayed all over the world. Many of the hospitals locally are displaying them. He is unquestionably a genius as far as his representation of Civil War people. Again, you may not think this is good for a 9-year-old, but when you hear him talk about each of these persons and what they're doing and what battle this was and whatnot, you have to recognize that he is one of the extraordinary persons in terms of his being a prodigy of history and connecting it with art. Now, remember, I said there's some people who may be smart in one area, but have no common sense in another area. This would be a perfect example of this young 9-year-old kid. So I started thinking about it because this happened now before September 9th, before I went to Stockholm. And as a result of thinking about this, I realized, because I now have access to Einstein's brain, I will be taking a sample from forebrain, a sample from the amygdala, a sample from the cerebellum, and a hair follicle for each of these 9 people I've talked about. And I will be able to compare the SNP profile, the single nucleotide polymorphism profile for each of these sections of brain. I can't take a brain sample from this young kid. That would be unethical. But I would love to have a sample, perhaps at the time of his death. What became clear to me as I started thinking about this particular case and Albert Einstein is that Albert Einstein may be a genius not because of his genetic or inherited background. It could be that he became a genius because of his nurturing background. Remember that Einstein was not the best socialized being. He married a cousin. He had difficulties in a number of ways. And it's possible, it's conceivable to me, his genius comes from just the sum total of forces that were related to the way he was brought up. So I want to come back now to this overall graph here or chart that I've said. And instead of, let me make one additional point. When you talk to the older child or the adult of a child who has been traumatized, is the first word I would use in childhood, or a second word I will use is terrorized in childhood, you'll find that they will talk about it as trauma or terror in adult life, but they cannot articulate that view in childhood because they don't know the words. They don't really know what's right or wrong, what's good or bad, what's hot or cold or whatnot, because they've had these arrested developments during childhood. So I'm in fact raising the question about the sum total of Osama bin Laden's nurturing experiences, so much so that he has been able to turn the world up on its end. I would speculate in part because his father died in an airline, in an air crash. He realizes that this device could become a bomb or a deadly device where we would not think of that because we have not had the experience of a near close kin dying in an aircraft. Now, we'll never know that because the government is going to kill him, I'm sure, if they lay their hands on him. They would not allow us to get a real psychological profile on what's going on. But these are the kinds of questions that it would be really nice if we had the time to get a sense of, to accumulate that information. I have a student at ITP who's looking at the question, what happens when a child has been abused in childhood, and what effect does it have on spirituality? In fact, one of the interesting things that I've observed, if you look at the people who go to what I call the holy churches, where they get up and they shout and they get fervent about music and they clap and they sing, I have observed that many of those persons have had highly or very traumatic past. They've been shot at, or they've had major accidents, they've had traumatic situations in marriage, they've been divorced, or just a whole range of experiences. So in fact, I'm about to embark on another set of studies in which I talk about what I call diseases of the transpersonal. It's reasonable to have a spiritual experience. It's not reasonable to have an experience that is extreme. It's reasonable if you're Catholic to go through the Mass and go through confession and to do one or more traditional religious things. But is it reasonable to be a Catholic and engage in prostitution? Or the prostitution is not a good example. We have a set of cases right now before the church where Catholic priests have been known to abuse children, and the church has been protecting them. This is in the news within the last couple of weeks. Is this an appropriate religious experience? Is this an appropriate religious behavior or spiritual behavior of some sort? So I want to begin talking about the range of spiritual experiences, the range of leadership experiences, the range of emotional experiences, and what have you. I want to have a sense of what is within normal limits and what is beyond normal limits on the upper extreme and on the lower extreme. And make sure you hear what I'm saying. I am not saying that I'm opposed to any form of religiosity. I couldn't care less whether one is Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or Islamic or what have you. But it is reasonable to ask the question, is Osama bin Laden way off the scale in some sense of his sense of the Islamic tradition? Is it way off the scale that Ariel Sharon behaves in the way that he behaves towards the Palestinian people? Especially given that some of these people have been through the Holocaust and they have experienced the worst forms of atrocities, how can they inflict the same forms of atrocities on others, that they would bomb the houses and bulldoze them and make them homeless? Now, again, I'm not making a political comment. I'm asking you to reflect on what is normal limits within religious behavior. Secondly, might that not be reflected in some molecular changes in DNA? So that's almost the crux of the message that I'm here to give, that the future of psychology, psychiatry, is such that we have now new tools emerging where we will be able to possibly anticipate, would be the statement I would make. If we start catching kids at an early age and we watch their development and we see that they're going awry in some way, as we now develop models of how these DNA changes, we may be able to stop things. We may be able to catch child abuse. We may be able to anticipate, as my student Maria is doing, that persons who have endured certain kinds of childhood experiences live on the margin, on the extreme of the spiritual experience. She happens to believe that these kids, these adults, have more clairvoyance and more paranormal skills that others might have. Now, to give just an example of her situation. She alleges that she was abused as a child. And in fact, one of the issues that is going to come out of this work, I believe, is the notion of what constitutes child abuse. If we spank a child, is that child abuse? We have the notion, spare the rod and spoil the child. Is there not a certain window of opportunity where spanking is reasonable, but where it's not reasonable? You don't slap an adult or a 10-year-old or knock them to the floor. That's what I think we would all agree would be abusive. But if you're a 2-year older and you're running into the street, you can't necessarily take the time and reason, well, child, John, if you run in the street, you'll get hit by a car. You may have to spank them. So it may come out of this work that we will be able to circumscribe forms of punishment, if we can call it that, which are appropriate but not appropriate at other times. The example I'm going to give for the student is that on Father's Day this year, when she was telling me the thesis project that she wanted to pursue, she was talking about her relationship with her father and how she perceived it was abusive. And I said, why don't you call your father? She said, absolutely not. I don't want anything to do with him. This is the most horrible person in the world. My brothers were the same way. I was abused by them. I said, look, do me this one special favor of calling your father and saying, Happy Father's Day. I left her and drove immediately to Long Beach. And by the time I got to Long Beach, there was a message on my answering machine that said she called her father and she had the most wonderful dialogue that she's had in a long time. They talked about how the father could not get to her wedding because he was not able to drive. She knew that, but she didn't understand the circumstances. Now, here's a person who's going to tell us that she has great paranormal skills that can predict all kinds of things, but she could not predict what her father would do. I'm not saying anything is right or wrong about this. I'm simply trying to make the point that the nature of stimulation, I don't even want to call it trauma, terror, or whatever it would be, at one age can influence behavior at another age. And we now need to start seeing that as a big picture. For example, in the case of Osama bin Laden, I'm asking the question, was he in fact provoked? I don't know if the person was here that asked the question, George, about the penultimate. who sent that note? Anyway, I got a note when I said I was going to give this talk. You'll note that in the announcement I talk about the penultimate terrorist action. The question that I was struggling with is, could it not be that George W. Bush's negativism was so provocative that it was the final straw, so that a person said, all right, flip the switch, have three planes flying off, two from Boston, one from New York, one from Washington, or wherever they were. Let's prove a point. And that's the same point that was made with the bombing of the two American embassies. Let me show you that I can be the person. The passive-aggressive person never perceives themselves as being passive-aggressive. But that's, in fact, what we see is passive-aggressive behavior, in this case, at an extreme. Again, I'm not trying to justify what's happening. I'm asking the question, could we not have anticipated some of these things if we stopped and we looked at the sequence of back-and-forth political moves that were taking place between January of 2001 and September of September 11th of 2001. I obviously don't know the answer to this. I would love to know the answer, but we will not know the answer unless we find a way to not only capture Osama bin Laden, but to interrogate him in a reasonable way and not get into this demonization stuff that we tend to see going back and forth between the evil empires that Ronald Reagan would talk about it, or the evil doers that George Bush talks about. He would never consider himself as being evil, but he would consider everyone else. That is, in fact, a classic phenomenon of the negative behavior. During the Ronald Reagan's administration, we called it what? The Teflon presidency. Who was the person who gave it that term? The negative person never sees themselves as being negative. They always see themselves as being the ultimate right. But what they don't see is that the rage and the anger that this foments leads to kids wanting to kill their parents. In fact, I was reading just before coming up here this weekend about some child that somewhere in the Bay Area here has just been jailed. What is the situation? He attempted to kill his mother, and his brother now is going to move his mother in with him. They don't know what to do with the house. How could it get to a point where a person could want to kill a parent? It happens when you have these overwhelmingly negative forces where you simply don't see a way out. And if you look at Osama bin Laden, this isn't a frivolous act of his. It is a very logical, consistent act, which we may or may not like, but we have to ask the question. This is what I call the national caveat emptor. Could it not be that if we, and I'm not saying that Al Gore would have been any better of a president. In fact, people are making a big point about how great George Bush is as a presidential, or war president, I think is the way they're framing the issue. And again, I'm not taking a stance on that. I'm asking the question, might we not be in this current situation if we had a different form of leadership, not just with George Bush, going back throughout all of our foreign policy. Think about it. This foreign policy has given us an Enron that just went bankrupt, and it's given us the Bush administration, if you were not aware, was negotiating with the Taliban to get an oil pipeline across Afghanistan. They were so fixated on this oil industry and what it might mean for them, possibly money, possibly influence, possibly something else. And again, I'm not particularly concerned about the specifics. I'm concerned about the broad issues. So, to summarize, I'm saying to you several things. First, some experiences I had with young kids in 1985 has given me insight into aberrant common sense in one dimension. Hadn't thought about emotions, hadn't thought about cerebellar changes until I dealt with this young kid here, nameless kid. And I began to see that he reveals basically how we could have logic without common sense. The second point I'm making is that there is a particular force, which I call negativism, which can be particularly overwhelming and which can lead to rage and other behaviors that can be catastrophic in the long run. And I believe that the World Trade Center events is, in fact, a consequence of that. The third thing I'm saying is that as a result of two scientific breakthroughs this year, one being the sequencing of the human genome, and two, just the experience of being in Stockholm in October, where I just happened to be at a conference where they're talking about SNP technology, I finally realized that I can now make the breakthrough in showing how DNA is changing, and it would not change in one particular structure of brain. It may take place in multiple structures in brain. Another point I'm making is that I now see the proper experiment where we can exercise the proper experimental control, because after all, for each person we'll have a hair follicle, so we know what the baseline DNA is like. and then we can look at the DNA from the forebrain, from the amygdala, from the cerebellum, and we compare those things. And if we do see that there are differences, believe me, that will be the breakthrough of the century. Thank you. Another point I'm trying to make is that we have an opportunity, which I hope we don't lose politically, to go back. If we can capture Bin Laden and some of his lieutenants, we have an opportunity to go back and take a real hard look at what might be the precipitating factors for this situation. Now, that's not going to be a trivial issue. It's going to take some great insight and interrogation and whatnot. But the point is that the last thing we need to do is to execute someone just for the sake of execution. In fact, I think that we have some lessons to learn from the Europeans, especially, that a death penalty policy is fundamentally flawed, that there's no reason to kill, even if a large number of lives has been lost. And believe me, I do sympathize. I am concerned about those losses in life. I'm also concerned about finding a way that we can learn from this particular situation. I'm also saying to you that the set of experiences that we have over a lifetime can be particularly important in terms of shaping how we live our lives. I'll end with a sort of a vignette that has recently happened. I'm turning 60 years old in a couple of weeks, the 19th, which is this coming weekend. And so what I decided to do for my 60th birthday is to throw a big, what I call a big birthday bash. I invited about 150 people from all over the world to Long Beach, starting out as going to a great blues venue, Tommy Castro, for those of you who know him, and then Saturday morning, that was Friday night, Saturday morning we went to the Getty Museum to see a particular exhibit called Wonders, the Devices of Wonder. Saturday afternoon we took them to see some Guatemalan artifacts from the Aboriginal people of Central America. We had a Greek meal on Saturday evening, and then we had a steel drum band playing, and on Sunday we went up to Santa Barbara and had a lunch along the beach. About 68 people came to this birthday bash, and out of it is going to come a novel. A woman named Maureen Earle, who won an Emmy Award for her documentary on rape, had been sort of, she had a sort of writer's block, but it opened her up now that she, the experiences have gotten her back into writing. A friend who lives here in San Francisco has had melanoma and has been treated in the NIH. And what he said to me in the notes he sent back, he said, "Rivette, this was the most fantastic experience I've ever had in a lifetime." He said that, since my diagnosis, I never realized how valuable life could be until I had this much fun for the weekend. Now, what I'm saying to you is that the nature of nurturance, the essence of nurturance, is such that we need to think differently about labeling things as terror or as trauma. There is terror, there's no question about it. But is the terror of the World Trade Center the equivalent of the terror of the bombs being dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima? Or is it or Afghanistan? Or what about the freedom fighters that we sponsored in Central America, Guatemala? Or what about our sponsoring Osama bin Laden? Our CIA did that because they were backing the Mujahideen because of the Soviet situation, fighting the Soviet presence in Afghanistan. We have been one of the most terroristic nations in the world, if we stop and think about it. And again, I'm not making a political comment in the sense that I am saying this right or wrong. I'm asking you to stop and think, if we're going to have a war on terrorism, when do we stop and reflect on ourselves? That would be the message. So I'm really grateful for this opportunity to have chatted with you today. I know that what I have to say is provocative. I want you to see this in the broadest sense of science, because I'm now talking about fundamental science, science at molecular level. I'm asking you to stop and think about the public health implications of the science that I'm talking about. I gave you the example of Ground Zero. You know, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, for which my daughter works, they don't see mental health as being a public health issue. But this is fundamental public health. We talk about post-traumatic stress. Think about the level of post-World Trade Center stress that's taking place in New York. I mean, we see this plane flying into the building over and over and over because of the way the television works. What is this doing for our kids? What about the kids in Stuyvesant School there who actually saw the plane fly into the building? What about the people who've been displaced? What about the fumes and stuff? What about the body parts that we've seen? You know, if you think about it, we've not seen too many whole bodies out of this experience. What about some of the moral and aesthetic issues? An Alexander Calder sculpture was lost in this event. Should we build new high towers, 100 stories high, or should we memorialize this situation in some way? We have gotten to the point that we don't build on Indian burial grounds. Why should we build another large structure on the site of the World Trade Center? Is it just money? Is it purely economics that is at stake? What do we teach our students in psychology and whatnot? Should we not ask a student to write a thesis on the World Trade Center situation? What about the arts? Should we not take pictures of the dismantling of the World Trade Center, showing piece by piece how this thing is, how we're dealing with rubble? And what about the landfill over in Staten Island? What is to be said about that? There are enormous questions that come out of this. We'll begin to ponder. And I think it's one of the most exciting events. It's a sad event, there's no doubt about it, but it's exciting in the sense that we have new opportunities for new and rich intellectual breakthroughs well beyond what we saw with the Sputnik back in 1957. I haven't seen data. I know that I heard talk of what they want to do. I'm in touch with the NIH and the NSF recently because of my memory model here. And you have to understand that people are not yet at the level that they can perceive the DNA can change. I mean, I proposed this theory in 1979, and in 1982, 83, I got a review back from someone saying this is an idea for the dustbin. So I've always laid low and not said very much because I didn't want to just provoke people. If the NIH is just now beginning to open up to some possibilities, and they're looking not only at my molecular models, but they're looking at some new trauma models that I know of, but it's in an image, I guess it is. I'm not optimistic that they're at a place where they are really prepared to see some big stuff. in my view. Now, you may know them better than I know them. Surely I provoke more questions than that.
Absolutely. My question is, you were talking a little bit more about spanking, and I'm curious, in recent years it's been removed from school systems in America. What influence do you think that has had on the development of kids in this country, positive or negative? The fact that there's,
it's a really good question, and unfortunately, I don't have an answer for it. I don't even have a real view on it. The spanking phenomenon, and I started thinking about this for precisely the same reasons that you are identifying, namely, how should we deal with punishment in the school systems? I have no doubt that the Catholic schools still spank kids, and they argue that it's right, but you don't see it in any of the mainstream public schools. The reason the question is really good is because it raises the question. It raises the point that I've been struggling with as I started thinking about the design of this experiment. We really need a longitudinal study to systematically look at how the changes from spanking in the public schools, corporate punishment, how that may have contributed to some of the childhood behaviors that we now see. I just don't know that anyone is systematically looking at that. I've been thinking about it for about 3 months now, since October, when I started seeing the implications of my study. But I have not come across any systematic implications, systematic studies, which have answered the question. I've heard people debate it, but I don't see any hard evidence that supports it one way or the other. And remember, what I'm saying is that there may be certain ages where spanking could be appropriate, but other ages where it's not. So it's not an either or. It's just much more complicated. It would be interesting for those of you who are older than me, for example, if there's anyone older than me in the room, to weigh in on spanking if you had kids. Whether you do you have kids?
Yes, she will be 16 each month.
Okay. did you ever spank her?
Just once.
And
very destructive to deliberately.
But the kind of question that George is asking here is, was the spanking for your own satisfaction or for her destructive behavior? No, there's no question.
I was mad. I didn't know.
And the question then would be, did it have the desired effect? Because after all, if this is only once in a lifetime, if you can think about it, it must have had some profound impact on hers, I would think. I was saying to someone yesterday, the major spanking that I can remember in my life was my father saying, he had a garden, and he said, straddle the row to pick these string beans. And I don't know how old I was, but I was too embarrassed to say to my father, I don't know what the word straddle means. So he kept saying, straddle the row and pick the beans. And what he really meant is climb over the row and pick the beans. But he didn't understand that I didn't understand, and so I got a spanking. And I do understand the reason for spanking now. I never told him this. It did teach me something. It taught me to speak and speak honestly about what I know and I don't know. But that's spanking that I remember, and I didn't get spanked much. I may have been spanked once or twice. I remember my mother shouting once and throwing something at me, but that was not a spanking. It was just, as you say, it was a moment of passion. I don't know, to answer your question, George. We clearly have some people who are abusive. And I would dare say they probably learned their abusiveness from their parents. And so if there's anything, any message is to be brought out of this, is that there is this transmissibility of culture, and that does concern me.
And I thank God that I had good parents, not that I ever thanked, but giving a tax break to parents and paying parents money. And give strategies for dealing with children that don't involve physical interaction, but most of the children how to do that.
I've long felt that society in general needs a set of classes on not only parenting, but on husbanding and wiving.
The
tax break is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, a tax break or maybe something better. And so he certainly makes those points also that when we look at the, I would call it collective insanity that we see so frequently that is institutionalized as our culture and the directions that we're currently going, globalization, this world dominance in so many ways to the exclusion of life-affirming abilities. It just seems to me that I mean, I applaud what you're doing in terms of trying to get some kind of understanding and balance point between the cultural influences and the physiological, biological consequences and potential evolutions as a result of that. And I guess what just amazes me is that most people don't seem to see the insanity in the world in as sharp a foreground as to me would seem so evident.
I want to stop on one first point you made. You talked about the globalization phenomenon. We first had the globalization of economies and the globalization of communication. What this terrorism is all about is the globalization of war. That really is the big breakthrough, I believe, is that it forces us to see this big picture of globalization, one which we had not seen before. Again, I'm not taking a view, a position on whether it's right or wrong, but I am suggesting that we have something to stop and think about. That terrorism is just an extension of what happens at the personal level, at the family level, at the community level, at the national level, and now at the global and international level. As for your other point, I guess all I could say is that I really hope that we could find a way to get people to. I don't want people to intellectualize this process. I do want to see some balance between the intellectual and the personal, emotional, what have you. And I do also want to see more forethought going into this process. And that's part of when George and I first talked about this back in the fall after September 11th, why I agreed to give this talk. I have to be honest with you. I feared, and I'm actually glad that you didn't have this webcast, simulcast. This is a hot-button topic, and frankly, people would attack the messenger more than they would attack the message. So I actually feared for my life that if I came here and said something like this to you, there would be some people who would be very offended and just want to blow me away. Fortunately, it hasn't happened. I don't see anyone pointing a gun at me here. And fortunately, I've seen most of the people here before. But the point is that it is something that I struggle with about whether to talk about, because our society at this point was not prepared, is not prepared to talk about this. Who is it? There's a Buddhist actor. What's his name? Gear. He went to New York and he made some comment and they booed him. They would have ripped his guts out, I'm sure, if they had a chance. And that just taught me, it told me that you have to be really careful about how we deal with this issue right now. People are not prepared. In fact, as I was talking to someone about this yesterday, he asked the question, how do you distinguish between patriotism on the one hand and terrorism on the other hand? Because in the interest of patriotism, people really want, you know, they want to go after Iraq and they want to go after everyone in the world at this point. I'm not saying that there are not reasons to do some of these things. I'm simply saying that we're getting digital. There's a sense of illogic about what's going on that concerns me.
I think there's a level of hope in it. I had a chance to see Ralph Nader about, I guess it was October 2001, speaking at the Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco, and basically much of what he spoke on was going over our foreign policy for the past 30 years and the way we have not been fair to all sides in our policy over the past 30 years, how we've kind of contributed to provoking the situation, as you've alluded to. And he was well received. Of course, this was San Francisco. And I do agree with you. I mean, there are places in this country where you can say that. But if he tried to do the same thing in New York, you might be right. You probably would have had more difficulty with it there than here. But still, he could say it here, and he was well received for it here.
I see the point.
Just a question. You haven't really. There's a question of chicken and egg, and the flyer, at any rate, spoke of the influence of negative leadership. So, my question in response to that would be something like, to the extent that this culture is tolerated and the political process is tolerated, and these leaders are in fact elected, do they not represent their followers? Are these leaders not following the voters?
In the case of George Bush, I cannot say that he is following the voters. He in fact, there was a big speculation at the very beginning when the Supreme Court elected him, because it was really the Supreme Court that did this. What was his advisor at the time, who was a former Secretary of State, Baker, said, well, we're going to go ahead and do all these things that were our agenda, and there just weren't the votes there to say that, in his case, that he happened to have a Republican Congress so he could push through the tax package. But had September 11th not happened, he would not be getting the free ride that he's getting right now, at least in my view. Now, your point, though, goes beyond George Bush, Ronald Reagan, others who we clearly elected. And there is this, as you say, chicken and egg phenomenon, which I would like to cast as the caveat emptor phenomenon, that people need to think and see a kind of a bigger picture if they could. Our society, though, is not trained to think about the broader picture. How often are we taught to sit? Well, a very good example, Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt had polio, if you remember. You never saw him standing, or if he did, it was very rare. That's because the newspapers didn't want to report that. And
they never saw him in a wheelchair.
Right.
There was an unspoken agreement with the press that they would never photograph him in a wheelchair.
Right.
Yeah.
Would that have made a difference if they showed his infirmity? I don't know. Remember that Muskie, he had electroshock or something?
He cried.
Well, no, that was, he cried, but there was...
It's a different sound of some of them, for sure.
Yeah, okay. The guy who's going to be vice president.
Well, but the point is that we would focus on those kinds of things, but we would not stop and ask the question, what could be the consequences of a foreign policy that is based solely on polluting? I mean, if you stop and think about it, arsenic in water, oil drilling, the Kyoto Protocol, the logging in the roadless areas, this administration has done things. In fact, you have proposed an issue that I want to think about even further. It's not chicken and egg. It's at such a level that these people don't even know the conception issue. You know, when you talk about a chicken and egg, you have you've had an act that led to some conception. What we have is it's not naive. It is a society that is just on autopilot. That doesn't really take the time to think about any kinds of issues.
Counterintuitive corporations and it's global corporations that are causing resentments toward us by depleting the water tables with mining and doing all kinds of things that pollution the water and disrupting whole environments and causing people to have to leave to go to the towns that are overcrowded and have no jobs for them. But our voting public, my impression is that the thoughtful educated enough to satisfy the Jeffersonian criteria.
Yes, thank you.
And yet we would criticize any country that doesn't have our sense of democracy, which of course is a democracy that doesn't require that you vote. At least we should force people to go to the election polls, and they do in Australia.
They're required.
They're fine if they don't vote in Australia.
Mm.
Really?
Yeah, very good question.
Your earlier question, how do you distinguish between patriotism and terrorism? That reminds me of something that Albert Einstein once said, or said that nationalism is the measles of humanity. Albert Einstein is the victim of nationalism. I have a question for you. Your research protocols, I'm a big fan of good solid baseline and good solid control. And with your particular protocols of taking hair follicles and samples, postmortem from different groups, there's, by its nature, there's no solid control or baseline in that. Would it be possible to consider changing the protocols, dealing in terms of chemical changes in adults, volunteers, not postmortem, but taking chemicals and perhaps brain samples and neurotransmitters as adults after a control period, after a particular baseline occurs, all the variables are exactly the same, and then just change one variable, one intervention. That's the pure scientific method, as I understand it, is to change, keep all the variables exactly the same for a long period of time, good solid baseline, don't change anything at all, tell one group they're a placebo and the other group they're a test, and then give the placebo to everybody. have a solid baseline, carry on for 3 months if necessary, make no change whatsoever,
and then make one change in one half of one group without anybody knowing it, double blind.
I actually thought extensively about this too. I thought what you're going to say is that maybe I should look at all males or all females just for control. In statistics, we distinguish between group analyses within subjects and cross subjects. And when I struggle with this, I use the hair follicle because that does provide a baseline control, a very good baseline control. But your point is well taken that I don't have the same person over a long period of time. So in fact, the reason I looked at the twins raised together and raised apart is you do have more of a control where identical twins who raised together for a substantial part of their life, you should expect to see less difference than a situation where you have identical twins who've been orphaned and raised apart greatly. So I've tried to deal with these controls. Now let's take the specific point that you're making. The point I'm trying to make is that about the neurotransmitters and whatnot, is that if the thesis is correct, you will not find clear markers like neurotransmitters or other kinds of things. And furthermore, one of the complications is I don't really know where to start to sample from RAIN. So I agree that the experiment is fraught with some challenges, but to use the 9 samples, which I'll be able to get, gets me as close to possible to getting some answers. And remember, the other internal control is the 3 regions, the amygdala, cerebellum, and the forebrain. That if I simply had a hypothesis that DNA is changing, one would ask, well, why not the change is uniforming throughout all sections? So if I can demonstrate any change whatsoever, done what I'm going to do, and I will get my Nobel Prize, there's no question about it. Then the question is, as you're raising, what can we do next to systematically show the nature of those changes, possibly using not neurotransmitters. What I would recommend is the NMR, and the reason is because we are talking about basis where the phosphate moiety registers on the magnetic resonance scheme. And so when you're changing from a AT-rich to a GC-rich basis, you should be able to see the changes under some systematic experimentation. So that's the way I reason it through. But I'm always open to other ways of doing things. But I'm saying that there is no evidence there will be any genetic markers. That is what is so exciting about what I'm doing, and the evidence is that when we treat psychiatric patients, we treat them symptomatically. So when we are looking at neurotransmitters, we really have no specificity about any subregion in RAIN because we're talking about the flooding of the neurotransmitter about some section, whether it be serotonin or any other neurotransmitters. They're full of them. What we really want is a single marker of an axonal dendritic connection, but that's what I said is teleologically not. My God would never do things that way.
Do you have any opinion of the work that I'm not very familiar with, but titles like The Neurophysiology of Enlightenment and the supposed breakthrough state, I don't know how they're measured subjectively, correlate with cooling of the system?
I don't know about the cooling. I have been thinking of the enlightenment issue, and I'll tell you why. This is the name out. Is the light bothering you? There's a disease, Tourette syndrome, where people with Tourette's have a disinhibition of a negative pathway. So they are normal people, but there is a disinhibition of that pathway that says, don't allow them to say this, or don't allow them to say that, or don't allow them to say the other. And so I've asked the question, what would be the opposite of Tourette syndrome, where, in fact, you're not disinhibiting negativism in some way, you're disinhibiting positivism. You know, the person who says, oh, I just love God, and go on and on and on about praise the Lord and what have you. So I was thinking about this just yesterday, about whether enlightenment is in fact the real opposite of this phenomenon of negativism. So if that is the case, I was saying to myself, Buddhism, or the Buddha, if we think of him that way, really reflects the penultimate of disinhibition of something that we call ultimately enlightenment. Now, to answer your question, there are several people who talk about DNA stuff. There's a fellow in Corsgo, California. What's his name? Can't remember his name. Who talks about the DNA stuff. And it has always been kind of hand-waving. And there's nothing wrong with waving hands. Don't get me wrong. I'm just trying to make my hand-waving a little bit more concrete. And what I would say to you is that once I have... The critical step is to demonstrate that DNA is changing. Once we do that, we're going to open the floodgate for people to begin looking at what are the correlates of DNA change. So I have to demonstrate the first fundamental change, and then I can sit back and die. It doesn't matter. People go on and do the rest of the work, and I have no doubt that they're going to be looking at the kinds of things that you're talking about, but I have to demonstrate that first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to follow up on your question, I was going to ask it, or recommend that, considering the Tibetan condition today is perhaps one of the best ones that we could look at for looking at this, this process of just talking about the discondition of positivism, or say, people who have been through decades in labor camps, in the most horrific human rights atrocities we can imagine, nuns and monks who continually use a process of entrainment to generate compassion, to see the sort of roots of the suffering of their captors or oppressors. And the entire sort of effort of this people is to not continue the cycle,
mm-hmm.
but to break the cycle. And to find the most sort of catalytic antidotes to sort of break through the negativism.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the Tibetan situation. It's interesting to me for two reasons. One of the things I've always admired about the Dalai Lama, if you've ever paid attention to him, he always manages to laugh. I don't know if you've ever watched him speak. He comes up with the most charming laughter. When he makes his point, take the next time you look at him, watch that, how that happens. The second thing that, and this came out of a class I taught late last year, someone asked the question, he was looking at Tibetan Buddhism, he asked the question, how can we deal with the notion of non-self? And I jokingly said, you know what we really need, my son is a professional golfer, I said, you know what we really need is the notion of par in spirituality in general, and in Buddhism in particular. So the Dalai Lama would be a scratch Buddhist, and we would have everyone else being some unit away from par. Now, I know this may sound, you know, crazy, but as I thought about it, and I still think about it, your notion of what you call it entrainment and other steps and whatnot, your notion is such that we really do want to quantify and qualify whatever those features are, especially in Tibetan Buddhism, for reasons that for a variety of reasons, let's say, because of the way they have to deal with various conditions that they dealt with. Not least of which is their relationship to China, and what that might teach us, nonviolence and whatnot. I would like to carry that several steps further. I was in South Africa last year for the AIDS conference, because I'm an AIDS researcher, and I was struck by South Africa being a bastion of social justice, whether we like it or not. It's what gave us Mahatma Gandhi. It gave us apartheid, whether we like it or not. It gave us a Nelson Mandela. And it gave us something most recently, the Bishop Tutu's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that you speak truth and we reconcile things. This is an extraordinary notion if you stop and think about it. And it's worth trying to put the way the Dalai Lama and the way the South African society tries to deal with these things, put them in some broad context. The Tibetan situation comes to mind for another reason, for a medical reason. I'm fairly close with a fellow named Yeshe Donvan. He is the former physician to the Dalai Lama. He comes to the San Francisco Bay Area twice a year. I think he still does. I get a note from him every year around Christmas time.